So good morning again, and welcome to Resurrection Church. Vance and Becky are at their monthly trip to the beach today, so I'm getting to be the deacon and the priest roles today. But glad they're able to get away and have some time together. I think they're fellowshipping with one of our sister churches, Christ Our Hope in Wilmington. Well, if you're worshiping out with us for the first time today, this is the fourth season of Lent. Lent is the time where we prepare for the death, the crucifixion of Christ. We have our Lenten icon highlighted and spotlighted there on the wall with scenes from the cross. And I've just returned from Rwanda. Ted and I had the opportunity to visit Rwanda for almost 2 weeks, so I've been doing Lent a little bit differently this year. I've been reflecting on the first trip to Rwanda that I've taken in 20 years. I was ordained as a deacon in 2004 by a Rwandan bishop named John Rishihana at Emmanuel Anglican Church in Destin, Florida. And I've been looking forward to going and seeing the country, and I got to do that just about a month ago. So I've particularly been reflecting through a book that Ted happened to have in his bag called The Good Shepherd, a thousand-year journey from Psalm 23 to the New Testament. And this morning I would like to reflect on Jesus as the Good Shepherd as he seeks and saves the lost in the people of the Hutu and the Tutsi. So I'm going to give you a short little history lesson here. I was a history major in college. I love history. And when we were in Kigali in particular, we toured the Kigali Genocide Museum. Literally, you're going down the road and they have genocide memorials, just like a little fence with a garden and some monuments in it, kind of like we would have parks here. Like there was a mass grave, let's put a memorial. Another mass grave, let's put a memorial. It's just scattered as you go down the road. And the museum gives you the history behind the genocide. And one of the you're hearing eyewitness testimonies, survivor testimonies, you're hearing government propaganda, you're hearing what the media said, what the schools said. And here's one of the things that caught my eye in the Genocide Museum. You can go look this up on Wikipedia to this day. It is called the Hutu Ten Commandments. They had their own Ten Commandments, and they published them widely. They made sure that the schools were aware of this, government buildings, radio, TV, etc. I'm just going to give you a couple samples of the Hutu Ten Commandments. Number one, do not marry a Tutsi woman or employ her as a secretary. Number four, every Hutu should know that every Tutsi is dishonest in business. His only aim is the supremacy of his ethnic group. As a result, any Hutu who does the following is a traitor, makes a partnership with a Tutsi in business, invests his money or the government's money in a Tutsi enterprise, lends or borrows money from a Tutsi. No business dealings at all. Number five, all strategic positions, political, administrative, economic, military, and security should be entrusted only to Hutu. By the way, this was on your identity card. Show up at a traffic stop, you're either a Hutu or a Tutsi. You got to know that on your identity card. Number seven, the Rwandan armed forces should be exclusively Hutu. Wonder why we need that. Number eight, the Hutu should stop having mercy on the Tutsi. Those were the first people killed in the genocide. It was the moderate Hutus who had mercy on the Tutsi because they were going to get in the way of a very detailed, administratively well-organized genocide. The first people to be killed were those who had mercy, Hutus who had mercy on the Tutsi. Number 10, the social revolution of 1959, which is when the Hutu came to power, the referendum of 1961, and the Hutu ideology must be taught to every Hutu at every level. We heard stories, literally they would have Tutsi kids stand up in the classroom, say, I apologize for being Tutsi, I am ashamed of myself, I should not be a Tutsi. They were nicknamed the cockroaches. These are the Tutsi cockroaches. They're just, that's what the propaganda on the radio was, the cockroaches. And so, it wasn't just teaching, it wasn't just words. In April of 1994, which is now Genocide Remembrance Month, the words became actions. The propaganda was put into practice. The machetes and the weapon stations were all over the country and spread up. The 40-person militias who were trained to kill 1,000 Tutsis in 20 minutes were ready to go. The kill lists were printed. Your name was on them or not on them. You'd been indoctrinated for decades, and particularly in the last 4 years, you'd been indoctrinated so that eyewitness testimony from a survivor, if you married a Tutsi as a Hutu, by the time the propaganda was done, you were telling yourself, I made a mistake in marrying this Tutsi woman. I made a mistake in marrying this Tutsi man. So they executed the plan that was put in place, took down the president's own party, own military, shot down his airplane, blamed it on the Tutsis. There's the spark you need to light the fire, which burned for a good 100 days. And now, Ted and I being in Rwanda 30 years later, we got to witness the ongoing attempts, the ongoing work, particularly on the part of the church, of rebuilding the country, rebuilding the relationships, rebuilding the society after all that propaganda took root, all that propaganda was acted on, and people are walking around with the ghosts in their head, in their closet, and the shame and the alienation and the fear that they feel as a result of that divide, of those actions. So this morning, I would like to reflect on the Hutu genocide against the Tutsis as well as other moderate Hutus in light of Jesus' words in John chapter 15, and particularly the divide that he's going to speak to in this passage, describing himself as the good shepherd, seeking and saving that which is lost. So like the Hutu and the Tutsi, our story begins with two groups that are alienated from each other and cannot get along. Listen to how the setting of the parables in Luke 15 begins. Luke writes, "Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to Jesus. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" Now, in his book, read this on the airplane on the way over by Emmanuel Collini, the first Archbishop of Rwanda after the genocide, who also started the Anglican Church in the United States, "Christ Walks Where Evil Reigned." He reflects on the genocide 13 years later. In 2007, he writes this. "During the 1994 genocide, there are countless examples of husbands or wives killing their own partners or giving them up to be killed together with one or more of their children solely because they were Tutsi or appeared Tutsi. Some pastors and church members behaved in just the same way." Then he records this. This was probably the most jaw-dropping part of the whole book for me. "Loss is one of the greatest areas of pain in the Rwandese people's lives. But few of us, either inside or outside the church, have the teaching or experience in how to deal with loss. Even though many passages of Scripture talk about loss of life, limb, loved ones, job, home, future hope, and even relationship with God, a theology of loss in a Rwandan setting has to be one of the greatest current needs in the church. For many, God has been part of the problem, so it is important that he now be part of the solution." We need a theology of loss. I think the population dropped by about 17%. They were around 6.7 million people in 1994. A million were killed. Do the math, you lose about between 15 and 17% of your population. Everybody knows somebody that they killed or that was killed in their immediate circle. How do you deal with that level of loss in society? And so both Emmanuel Collini as well as Jesus, they recognize that lostness is a true reality. They don't say to these people who participated in genocide or were affected by genocide, they were just following their heart. That's all they were doing. They were just following their heart as they killed your family members. That doesn't fly anymore when you're dealing with real atrocities. They didn't say to them, you do you and let them do them. doesn't comfort anymore. doesn't really have the ring of truth anymore when you're dealing with real atrocities. Both Emmanuel Collini and Jesus recognize that lostness is a real, painful, and dangerous reality. It's real, it's painful, and it's dangerous. Jesus is talking about a lost sheep, and he knows the clock is ticking. Once the sheep is lost, he knows the clock is ticking because it's nighttime. We talked about this last week. You do your count at the end of the day. You realize you're missing one sheep. You go look for that sheep. The wolves are looking, and you're looking. Who's going to find the sheep first? Amos was a shepherd. He said, I found the ear and two bones. The book of Amos. Jesus is going to look for the lost sheep. This is a real, painful, and dangerous reality. So in this sense, Jesus is agreeing with the Pharisees. I know you're upset with the sinners and tax collectors. I know they're lost. But he is also disagreeing with the Pharisees. In other words, Jesus doesn't say, they're not lost. Nothing to see here. No, there's a real problem. But here's where Jesus disagrees. Jesus does not despise the sinners and the tax collectors. He does not despise them. He has compassion on them and he looks for them. In other words, Jesus is giving a gentle rebuke to the Pharisees, saying, if you lost a sheep, you would go look for a sheep, wouldn't you? Shouldn't I be looking for the sheep that are lost from my fold? And by the way, it's your fold too because you're the leaders. Shouldn't you be rejoicing with me when they're found instead of despising me and grumbling at me? And in the same way, the Bible says to us, all we like sheep have gone astray. We're part of the story. We're part of the parable. The Bible doesn't deny we're lost. It doesn't say everything's okay. It says all we like sheep have gone astray. But, same but as the parable, but Jesus has compassion on us. He does not despise us, and he does not want us to despise ourselves and our lostness. And he does not want us to despise others and their lostness. He wants for us to be found, and he wants for others to be found, and he wants us to participate in finding the lost sheep. Just as he invites the Pharisees, like, come and celebrate. You'd celebrate for a sheep, let's celebrate for a human. Isn't a human greater than a sheep? Powerful parable about a sheep that is lost in the wilderness, in the open pasture, runs away, can't find their way back, has to be found by the shepherd, is brought back into the house, and there is great rejoicing at the end of the day. Well, the second story that Jesus is going to tell is the story of a lost coin. That was the story of the lost sheep. Here's the story of the lost coin, verse 8 through 10. He's going to tell three of these parables, which means he's really passionate about this topic. Holy, holy, holy means God's really holy. Lost, 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 found, found, found means it's really, really important. Second parable, or what woman having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost. Just so I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. There's a few things that are similar between the second parable and the first parable, and then there's a few things that are different between the two parables. Here are the similarities. In both parables, something is lost, a sheep and then a coin. In both parables, the thing that is lost has value. The sheep has value and the coin has value. In both parables, the owner is searching for what is lost and celebrating when they find what is lost. Now, here are the differences. The sheep knows it is lost. Remember I read you last week how a sheep behaves when it's lost. It hovers in place, it gets under a bush, and it just kind of bleats and bleats and bleats. Bah, bah, bah. It's paralyzed. The shepherd's firsthand account described the sheep knows it's lost. The coin does not know it's lost. The coin is an inanimate object. It's just in the floorboard somewhere. It doesn't know or even care that it's lost. Number two, the sheep is found by a man. The coin is found by a woman. So Jesus is including, he's appealing to both groups within his audience. And number two, and most importantly, I believe, is this. The sheep is lost outside of the house. Where's the coin lost? The coin is lost in the house. She's searching in her own house for her lost coin. N.T. Wright says, oftentimes when Jesus describes the word house in a parable, it's referring to the temple. Somebody's lost in the temple. Somebody's lost outside the temple, but somebody else is lost in the temple. Kenneth Bailey, talking about shepherding, tells the story of a Christian professor who is teaching in China, at a university there. When the communists came to power, he was arrested and interrogated for 2 years about this parable. Amazing, the mentality here. Listen to the story. As the Second World War came to an end in 1945, this is Kenneth Bailey writing, my late friend, Dr. Andrew Roy, was serving in China as a professor under the Presbyterian Church. When the communists came to power in China in 1948, Dr. Roy opted to stay in China. After a few weeks, he was placed under house arrest and then interrogated for 2 years before being allowed to leave. I was privileged to hear him discuss the details of those interrogations. His communist inquisitors kept trying to convince Dr. Roy that the teachings of Jesus were vastly inferior to the teachings of Marx and Chairman Mao Zedong. Jesus' parable of the Good Shepherd was prominent in those interrogations. The communists insisted that to leave the 99 in order to go after the one was irresponsible because the individual had value only as he or she contributed to, quote, the people. Jesus left the herd exposed to danger and thereby failed in his primary task. He irresponsibly risked the safety of 99% of the herd. Roy's answer was that the exact opposite was the case. By going after the one, Jesus gave the herd boundless security in that each of them knew, if I get lost, he will come after me too. A failure to go after the one would leave those same 99 with the ultimate insecurity, realizing this, quote, if I get lost, he will leave me to die. Yes, there was risk involved, but undeserved costly love was given to the one and thereby assured for the many. The radical nature of the shepherd's actions must not be overlooked. Like the Pharisees, the Communist Party thought they knew how to run the country and how to run the world. Too inefficient to go after the one and leave the 99 in the open field. Too inefficient, too dangerous. You can hear some military connections here, can't you? Leave no one behind. But Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, and he would say to the Communist Party, you're lost in your own house. You're lost in your own house. You don't understand the heart of the Father who owns the house. The heart of the Father is to seek and to save the lost and to bring them back. Don't despise the work that I'm doing. Celebrate with me. You're lost. You're in darkness. We need to light a lamp so we can go find your coin in the floorboard. I know you're still in the house, but you're still lost. There is a fearful mindset, a scarcity mindset. God doesn't have enough love for the tax collectors and the sinners and for me. He's going to make things too messy and disorganized. And there is a lack of compassion, which are all hallmarks of being lost in the house. A lack of love and a lack of compassion is a hallmark of being lost in the house of God. And in the same way, brothers and sisters, you and I can be lost in God's house. We can be lost through hopelessness. We can be lost through despair. We can be lost through fear, through bitterness, or through anger. But the good news is this. Jesus has compassion on the sheep that is lost in the wilderness, and he has compassion on the coin that is lost in the house. And he seeks and saves and goes after both. Jesus does not despise the Pharisee. Jesus does not despise the Communist Party. He loves them and he seeks them and he wants them to be found so they can have fellowship with the Father in the Father's house. Here's how the Lord brings it all together. in the third parable of two lost sons. Beginning in verse 25, Jesus continues driving home the point in a third parable. If you remember earlier in the story, I won't read the whole story, but the younger son had run away. He had asked for his father's inheritance, which was a huge insult in your face. I want you to be dead so I can have my money. He goes and he wastes all the money in sinful, wild living, prostitutes, etc. And here's what happens when he comes home and is welcomed with a party. Verse 25, now his older son was in the field. The father's older son was in the field. He stayed home and was dutiful, faithful. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, the servant said to him, your brother has come home and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But he was angry. The older brother was angry and refused to go into the house. Where is he? He's outside the house. His father came out and entreated him. Where did the father go? He went outside the house to go look for this older brother. Didn't even do that for the younger brother, by the way. Waited for the younger brother to come back, and then he welcomed him. Went outside the house to entreat him. But the older brother answered his father, look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. And he said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. Generous heart. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this brother of yours was dead, and he is alive. He was lost, and he is found. The first younger son, like the lost sheep, had run away from home, was lost away from the house, had squandered his inheritance with prostitutes and sinful living and rebellion and wickedness. The second son, like the lost coin, was lost inside the house through his own anger and fear and scarcity mindset. You have nothing for me, father, said, no, son. Everything I have is yours. I don't have nothing for you. You think that's my heart to have nothing for you, son? Everything I have is yours. Older brother, the second son, is lost inside the house. His heart comes out when he sees his father's generosity that he doesn't like. But the father is gracious and generous to both. He appeals to both to return to the house, both to be celebrated, both to repent and to learn the father's ways. And he is eagerly waiting to reconcile the Hutu and the Tutsi. The Hutu that are lost and the Tutsi that are lost. The Pharisee that is lost and the tax collector, the sinners that are lost. Jesus appeals to male and to female. Paul appeals to slave and free, to Jew and to Gentile. Well, on Thursday of this week, Brandy is a great gift giver, and she took me, as I mentioned a moment ago at the beginning, to see Stephen Curtis Chapman in concert at the Carolina Theater. He was playing in Greensboro. And had gone to see him 20 years ago. She took me to see him at Carpenter's Home Church in Lakeland, Florida. And in 2007, Stephen Curtis Chapman wrote a song called Cinderella. It's a famous daddy-daughter song. They'll play it at daddy-daughter dances a lot. I looked up the lyrics. He sang it at the concert on Thursday night. I'll read a first verse or two. Says, she spins and she sways to whatever song plays. Without a care in the world, and I'm sitting here wearing the weight of the world on my shoulders. It's been a long day, and there's still work to do. She's pulling at me, saying, Daddy, I need you. There's a ball at the castle, and I've been invited, and I need to practice my dancing. Oh, Daddy, please. Chorus. So I will dance with Cinderella while she is here in my arms. Because I know something the prince never knew. Oh, I will dance with Cinderella. I don't want to miss even one song, because all too soon the clock will strike midnight and she'll be gone. Verse 2, she says he's a nice guy and I'd be impressed. She wants to know if I approve of the dress. She says, "Dad, the prom is just 1 week away, and I need to practice my dancing. Oh, please, Daddy, please. So I will dance with Cinderella while she is here in my arms, because I know something the prince never knew. Oh, I will dance with Cinderella. I don't want to miss even one song, because all too soon the clock will strike midnight and she'll be gone." So Stephen Curtis Chapman wrote that song in 2007 about one of his adopted daughters from China named Maria. Two adopted daughters and then an older girl as well, probably a sibling group. In 2008, Stephen Curtis Chapman's teenage son, who was learning how to drive, accidentally ran over that daughter and killed her. Biological son ran over his adopted Chinese daughter, Maria, age 5, and killed her. Life flighted her to Vanderbilt Hospital, but she didn't make it. A year after he wrote a song in her honor, she was killed. And Stephen Curtis Chapman had to decide whether he was going to ever sing again. Ever sing again in concert, songs of joy, particularly this song. And so he wrote a book about it, and he described what it was like to sing Cinderella again for the first time after his daughter was run over. I think this is 2009, so he took at least a year to decide whether he was going to ever sing again. He says from his book, "And we launched into our normal concert set. I looked to my right where Caleb stood playing guitar." That's one of his sons. "And we smiled at each other. Behind me, Will," another one of his sons, "was on drums, playing every beat as if he was driving a stake deep in the ground, anchoring down to what is true. I couldn't have been more proud of my sons. The concert went incredibly well thanks to the audience's gracious support." Oh, sorry, let me skip back a little bit. I started in the middle of it soon. "As soon as we walked out on stage, people began applauding. Some were weeping, most were cheering us on. It was as though just showing up was already a victory. The applause lasted for several minutes." Again, first concert since his daughter was run over. "I wanted to speak to the audience before performing any songs. I don't know how far we will get," he says. "I don't know how this will go, but this is what we are choosing. I began by singing 'Blessed Be Your Name.' My voice was not strong, and I squeaked and cried my way through it. But we made it through the song. I said, quote, 'If that is true, then these other things are true too. Let's go.' And we launched into our normal concert set. I looked to my right where Caleb stood playing guitar, and we smiled at each other. Behind me, Will was on the drums playing every beat as if he was driving a stake deep into the ground, anchoring down to what is true. I couldn't have been more proud of my sons. The concert went incredibly well thanks to the audience's gracious support. Then we got to the spot in our concert set where I normally sang the song Cinderella. The guys in the band stopped and waited to see what I was going to do. At that moment, I said to the audience, 'You know what? I wasn't sure if I would ever sing this song again. And I'm not sure how well I can get through it tonight. But tonight, as I've sung these songs, I have become even more certain of the truth of God's promises. And the truth is, I am going to dance again with my little girl.'" A hush fell over the crowd, almost as though they anticipated that was going to be a holy experience. He goes on to say, "If everything in our life is simply to make things better or more comfortable in this present world, then when some unthinkable tragedy happens, we are destroyed. But if our hope is for eternity, and this life is getting us ready for that, if we really believe it, then I can sing this song, Cinderella, because I have an eternity to dance with my little girl." I began playing the introduction, and then I sang Cinderella, crying and squeaking my way through it. A few times I became overwhelmed with emotion and just had to let the band play, joining back in when I could. I finally made it to the last chorus. And when I came to the end of the section where I had originally written, quote, "'cause all too soon the clock will strike midnight and I know she'll be gone,' I spontaneously changed the words to, "'the clock will strike midnight, but I know the truth is the dance will go on.'" And with that change, the song took on even greater significance. I've sung it that way ever since. So we got to see Stephen Curtis Chapman in concert on Thursday night singing that song in 2024, but he sang again for the first time in 2009. You know what impressed me the most about him as a man? I was watching him play that song, and they put a picture on the screen of the two twin daughters who were both in their ballerina dress. He said, "I just danced with that one recently." And he pointed to the other one and said, "I won't be able to dance with that one until heaven." And he shook his head and he kept on playing. Do you know what he was doing in that moment? He was caring for his son that ran over his daughter. And then he was caring for his daughter who was dead. He just said, he didn't say, "My son killed her." He said, "I can't believe my son did such a foolish thing." He just said, "I won't be able to dance with her again until heaven." He loved them both. You know what Jesus is doing in this parable? He's loving them both. He's loving the Pharisees and tax collectors who ran away and did stupid stuff. But they wanted to come back and they sensed that Jesus might have them. And then he's loving the Pharisees who can't stand the Pharisees and tax collectors for coming back because they think they wasted their inheritance. They're the problem with Israel. They literally had a phrase, "If all Israel would keep the Sabbath for a day, the Messiah would return." Guess who's not keeping the Sabbath? Them. Guess why the Messiah's not coming back? Them. They're the problem. He said, "No, they're not. You're all lost. You're all lost. You all need to be found by me. I'm the good shepherd. Come rejoice with me. I've found my sheep. Let's have a party." That's what Stephen Curtis Chapman's doing. He was modeling the party of heaven through caring for his dead daughter and caring for his surely guilt-ridden but needing to move on and keep living life son. And they were playing music together in 2009. What a father to restore his son and his daughter and give them both honor. What a God to restore the Pharisees and the tax collectors and give them both honor. Teach them both the ways of the Father to return to the Father's house. Brothers and sisters, this is the God who can save Rwanda. This is the God who can save Hutus and Tutsis. This is the God who can save you, who can save your family, who can save your friends, who can save us. This is the God whose heart is big enough, whose staff is long enough to rescue the Pharisees and to rescue the tax collectors and all who will return to him in repentance and faith. That's all it takes. Bah, bah, I'm lost still. Bah, come find me. Bah, all right, got you. Let's go. That's all it takes. It's not rocket surgery, as Stephen Curtis Chapman said in his concert. It's not rocket surgery. Let's pray to this great shepherd who saves us and loves us and gives himself for us.